funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Whose approval do you seek to know when you've done your job well? Our 15 Minutes of Fame culture suggests that the best in their fields deserve public acclaim. But in fact, many highly skilled professionals tend to be overlooked outside a small community of experts who understand their talents. Think structural engineers overshadowed by rock star architects or fact checkers who don't get a byline of their own. These seemingly invisible workers find ways to derive self-esteem and job satisfaction merely from doing excellent work, which could mean they are the happiest workers of all. Author David Zweig explains in his new book, Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
This book centers around the idea that perfection equals invisibility. Explain that.
Well, I wasn't invisible myself for a number of years. I started out as a magazine fact checker. And with that job, the thing I realized was the better I did my job, the more I disappeared. In fact, it was only if I made a mistake that anyone would think of me at all. And with that type of job, if you do the job perfectly, no one thinks of you. You're invisible. And I began to wonder if there are other professions like this that share this same sort of inverse relationship between work and recognition, where most of us, the better we do our jobs, the more we're recognized. Yet in that job, it was the reverse. So, and I found that these people who I call invisibles are really in every field and in every industry, and they exist all around us, but we don't often think of them.
So since that time, you are the journalist who writes the stories, you're a public speaker, you're a musician, kind of a front of the house guy. Do you find that having done that invisible work, you are uniquely positioned not to forget how important it is?
Well, yeah, I mean, for one thing, as a former fact checker, that certainly affects the way that I work as an author and journalist today, for sure. But in the broader sense, yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. I've been asked about that a few times, this notion of, oh, you're a writer. The book, ultimately, Invisibles isn't about whether being out front is bad or not bad or whether promotion is bad or not. It's about people who are able to achieve an extraordinary amount. Many of the people who I interviewed for the book are at the absolute tops of their fields, but they got there by doing the opposite of what essentially most of us are told that we need to do to get ahead, that we need to, you know, raise your profile or have a platform, that you need to constantly be pushing yourself, CC your boss and your colleagues every time you do something well. These people show that there's another way.
And they tend to share this real passion for precision. Invisibles, by definition, therefore have to be self-motivated.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, they all share a few core traits, and one of the three main traits they share is meticulousness. So you see it again and again. Both amazingly, they actually use the word meticulous. It reached this point where, when I was meeting with yet another invisible, it was almost like this wait for it moment before they were going to come up with that word. But really, more than them talking about it, what I wanted to do with the book was that people could really be in their shoes, so to speak. And I traveled around the States. I went to Europe. I was in Asia. So you can really see the meticulousness in their work, not just hear about it or not just have someone citing, you know, some sort of academic studies, though there's plenty of that in the book as well. But the driver is really experiencing these people at work.
It's worth noting that there are lots of essential people in this world in low-wage occupations whose work doesn't get acknowledged. You know, farm workers come to mind. Your focus here, though, we should just let people know, is on professionals.
That's right. I mean, you know, a number of people, you think of Barbara Ehrenreich with Nickel and Dimed, among a variety of other writers, have written about people, you know, like the factory worker toiling away anonymously, or, you know, you think about the person who cleans your hotel room when you're not there. And so those people are critical and they're important as well. But what I was interested in writing about for the book were people whose work was really critical, people whose personal stamp had a big effect on whatever enterprise that they were a part of. Because these are people, unlike some of the others, you think about someone, you know, through whether lack of education or immigration status or what have you, that they didn't have options and they sort of were forced into this anonymous role. To me, what's fascinating is, let's look at people who, in our culture where attention seems to be valued above everything else, let's look at people who've chosen chosen to work behind the scenes, or they started a job and decided to stay there when they had all sorts of options. A lot of the people whom I met with are highly educated, very experienced, very talented and capable people who could have gone in a variety of different directions, but chose this behind the scenes role. Why is that? Why do they choose that role? And how did they get there? How did they become so successful if they weren't promoting themselves in the way that we're told, you know, that we need to do?
So I love the chapter where you write about people who design airport signage, something that most of us just take for granted. But when you stop to think about helping people find their way around, no matter what their cultural background, no matter what language they speak, it's a very tall order.
It's a remarkable. I really fell in love with this field. So in a division of environmental graphic design, it's called Wayfinding, aptly entitled. And a man named Jim Harding was the focus of that chapter. And he is a wayfinding expert. I met up with him at the International Terminal at Atlanta's main airport, which is the busiest airport in the world. And you're right. It's this remarkable mixture of really scientific research where they study different font sizes and the pictograms. You know, that image of that universal, quote unquote, man you see on the door of every bathroom around the world. You know, they call him the Helvetica man because he's like this typeface Helvetica. And so I get into all these different types of pictograms and fonts and all the different things they do. So when you're at the airport, you check in, you go through security, you grab a sandwich, you go to the bathroom, you get to your gate. Most of us are, you know, looking at our phone at the same time. We might be thinking about the office. We're doing five things, and you kind of get to where you need to go, usually only half paying attention. That's not an accident. You know, and the thing is, Jim Harding said to me, he's like, look, no one is leaving a thank you note in the comments box at an airport saying, hey, I just want to let you know I got to the gate really easily. Thanks so much. You know, for him, he said, my invisibility is a mark of honor. I'm glad when no one thinks of me. That's my job, is to just get them from one place to the next. And those environments are extraordinarily complex. So I was just fascinated by, well, what is the reward for Jim Harding and the other people like him in the really wide range of fields that I met up with? You know, what is their reward if they know when they're perfect that no one's going to think of them?
Since we mentioned international diplomacy, we should talk about people who are translators, because this is another very important job. So much pressure. You have to get it right. But nobody is sort of rolling out the diplomatic fanfare for the translator.
Right. One of the people who I met with in the book is a woman named Julia Wilkins Ari, and she is an elite interpreter at the United Nations. You know, and her job and that of her colleagues there at the UN is to really be this neutral conduit for diplomats from one nation to communicate with those of another. It's not hyperbole to say that the UN would grind to a halt without these people. And yet, of course, they are essentially unseen. They're invisible. Unless something goes horribly wrong, unless they make a mistake, that their job, when they do it perfectly, is for no one to notice them. In fact, they have their own little booths, which I was fortunate enough to sit in, which, by the way, as a side note, you know, all these people, you also begin to realize the power that invisibles have, that we assume that the person at the top of the pyramid, the CEO or whoever is, you know, on the front of the stage, that those are the most powerful people. But these behind the scenes people, the ones who really kind of make things go in our world, that's one of the things that I realized. So I was privy to sit in a closed door meeting of the Disarmament Council. There was a representative from North Korea there making all sorts of claims about nuclear war. This is stuff that's not in the press. It is now, I guess. But the fact that I was with the interpreters, I was able to get in. Whereas a regular person, you just would never have access to that environment. So I saw that again and again. So her job, again, when she does her job perfectly, no one is thinking of her. And, you know, what is her reward? How did she get there? And what I found for Ms. Wilkins-Ari and a number of them is that one of their big rewards is in the challenge of their work, that people who tend to be these very successful invisibles really seek out challenges in their work. And there's a tremendous reward that comes with work that is challenging but attainable. There's a whole field in psychology called flow, where they talk, you know, people talk about being in the zone or something like that. And this work as an interpreter they liken the mental strain to that of an air traffic controller. There was a study done on soldiers and Israeli soldiers, and that the interpreters have the same degree of like anxiety and stress as soldiers do. It's that they're limited to half hour sessions. It's because it's just so grueling on the mind to have to hear one language and then at the same time translate it and speak a different language without stopping.
And amazingly, there are all these really complex rules about what language you can translate from and into, depending on how well you speak it. So Wilkins Ari, in her spare time, goes around learning additional languages so she can push herself even farther.
A really remarkable woman. Yeah, you really did your homework. You read the
I read the book.
You read the book. Yeah, it's fantastic. She speaks a variety of languages. Most of the interpreters only speak, quote unquote, three different languages. And, you know, one of the points that she made is that there is a vast difference between someone who is bilingual and someone who can be an interpreter. So while interpreters really need to have an innate ability to do this, it really requires a lot of training to gain the true expertise. And I saw that again and again, that you think in order to be meticulous, that maybe that's just someone's nature. But, you know, one of the people I spoke with for the book is a man named Mark Levitt, who's a top graphic designer in New York. And he talked about how he's a little bit sloppy in his personal life. And when he was in design school, they had him with a pen drawing the same like two or three letters over and over and over and over again, doing these types of exercises where he ultimately trained to be meticulous. So we think that there are certain traits that's like, I'm not like that. I could never, you know, be like this. But what these people in the book show is that you can actually gain a lot of these traits through work and through the desire to build them up.
And many of these people are definitely well known within their fields. It's not as if nobody knows they're doing good work. It's just that they don't demand like public accolades.
That's right. You know, many of them are highly regarded within their fields. They're very successful. But for them, what this really comes down to in the end, it's really not even about whether you're visible or not. You know, I chose these people for the book because they really embody this personality type, this worker type that I'm talking about, where they're not seen. But in the end, it's not about whether you're seen or not. It's about what motivates you. And that's what I found time and again. So although that wasn't my aim when I started out with these people, I found that in the end, if they are motivated by gaining attention, that's very different than the people who are motivated. The invisibles are really motivated by the reward of the work itself, that the value of your work, not the volume of your praise. If that's what motivates you, what these people show, and again, in a whole range of industries, what they show is that that is a real clear path toward a lot of achievement and success. And beyond that, being very fulfilled. And there's something really heartening and encouraging about the message of these people in the book, because we think the larger message today in the culture is that that attention equals value, that you're going to feel good about yourself. And we all feel, hey, I'm having a good time on the radio with you right now, and I'm happy to have my name on the cover of my book. But what studies show is that that always fades, that if you want lasting reward, it has to come from within.
My guest is author David Zweig. His new book is called Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe you work in an invisible profession. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author David Zweig about his new book, Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, David, somebody says 20th century American architect, and everybody jumps to Frank Lloyd Wright, who was indeed a genius, but had like a whole phalanx of people behind and around him making sure that his buildings were structurally sufficient.
That's right. You know, one of the main profiles in the book is of a man named Dennis Poon. He didn't work with Frank Lloyd Wright. In fact, Dennis is very active today. He's working on, I believe, 3 of the 5 tallest buildings in the world right now. I met up with him at the Shanghai Tower while it was under construction, which is the 2nd tallest building in the world, the tallest building in China. And his role, really, he views himself as a person who takes on an enormous responsibility. When you think about, and that's one of the main traits of invisibles, is besides being meticulous, is also people, what I say, who savor responsibility. And I saw that the amount of workers underneath his umbrella, mm-hmm. combined with the billions, with the B, dollars that these buildings cost to create, combined with the pressure that, hey, without him, these buildings wouldn't stand. So there's an enormous amount of pressure on this guy. And I asked him, well, how do you handle all this pressure of the responsibility? And he said, it's an honor. And I just thought that was remarkable, this notion that most of us, you know, you might view responsibility as a burden, something we try to shy away from. But here's someone who, for him, he wanted that responsibility, and he didn't care whether it was known or not. He knows the public's not going to think about him, and that's fine. So one of the stories in his chapter that I talk about, though, as you mentioned, Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, to show the sort of honor code, if you will, of structural engineers, one of Frank Lloyd Wright's buildings, while it was under construction, I think it was Falling Water, that the structural engineers in the building knew that the plans were not safe. Frank Lloyd Wright didn't do enough to make sure that the building was going to hold up. But Frank Lloyd Wright was notoriously a very stubborn man, and they knew he would never agree to any alterations. So what they did was, without telling him, secretly, they went in and they made sure that all the joints and whatever else were properly secured. And many years later, doing what they call like a forensic sort of engineering on these buildings, they found that without them having done that, the building would have literally fallen down. So those are people, they knew that no one would ever know. You know, certainly not the architect or public for many years wouldn't know that they did this work, but they cared about the enterprise, about the project as a whole. And I found that again and again with these people, that you think in order to become successful, that you need to be this big blustery personality, you need to really put yourself out front and toot your own horn all the time. But what I found time and again with people in this whole variety of different industries is that you actually can get to the top of a field by viewing yourself not as this individual who's fantastic above everyone else, but as a member of a team. Who would have thought that people who view themselves as part of the larger enterprise, that they can reach the top? But that what they show, and what a lot of business research shows as well, is that there are many people in very high executive positions or just successful people in whatever enterprise that have that attitude. And I just thought it was a really powerful message that I think is lost largely today, that it certainly goes against the current of what I think most of us are told, with all these gurus and marketing folks telling us that we need to always raise our profile, you know, in the office and elsewhere.
I was really struck here by the link between, and you mentioned responsibility. Invisibles in particular like to feel that they are in control of what they're working on. Can you talk about the research and what it suggests about how that contributes to personal satisfaction?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the 3 main traits are meticulousness, this savoring of responsibility, and the core trait, which I think we're touching on, you know, basically in every comment here, is that they are ambivalent toward recognition. They just simply don't seek attention the way most of us do. But when you talk about power, when you know, most of us associate this notion of power and responsibility with being out front. You know, there's the expression like you put your name on something, you know, that politicians have their commercials. It's like, I'm so and so and I endorse this message, that's like the ultimate way of taking responsibility for something. But in fact, it's really the contrary. True responsibility and true power is someone who's working behind the scenes and doesn't care about them being known themselves to everyone. They care about the overall enterprise. And there is a lot of research that shows that these feelings, the sense of power and the sense of control, not surprisingly, is actually very, very fulfilling and very rewarding, number one. And number two, there's a lot of research that shows, and again, you forget about the research, you see it with these people who I interview in the book and where I'm with them at their job sites. But what we see is that people notice when you are responsible, when you take on these jobs. We, I think, operate under this fear, so many of us, that, you know, we're doing work that isn't being seen, that we can't, that it's not worth taking on a responsibility for something, no one's going to know. But it, actually, these people show that there is another way. They show that by taking on responsibility, by having that power, that they're rewarded internally, and also that others around them recognize their role within the enterprise.
Here's a good one from Wes, who writes to us via Twitter. He says, sports officials, if their name is in the paper, something has gone horribly wrong. But if they're doing well, I guess nobody thinks about them.
That is a really common one. One of the fun things about the book is that anytime I talk to someone about the book, and people, now that it's out, and people who had advanced copies, anytime someone reads it, it really just begs this interactive component, that while you're reading through the book, that everyone's just like, oh, they're like jotting down, you know, in the margins, what about a so-and-so? So there are so many people like this, like the sports official, you know, when you cut in and talked about the Obama press conference, let's not forget, you know, about speechwriters. This is someone who generally no one's thinking of them. We all know that presidents and politicians use speechwriters, but their whole role is to make someone else look great. And there's something that we miss, that there's something very rewarding. And it's a bit counterintuitive, but what these people show us, these are really satisfied people. There's something very rewarding about not trying to aggrandize yourself, but to work, whether it's for a specific person, like a politician, or towards the larger endeavor. One of the people in the book is a guy named Robert Elswit. And I suspect most of your listeners have never heard this name. But Robert Elswit is an Academy Award-winning cinematographer. And cinematographers, basically, right after the director, they have a larger effect on the look and feel of a film than anyone else. And when you look at that long scroll of names that comes up with the credits in a film, a lot of those people are under the umbrella of the cinematographer, the gaffers and the grips, etc. So here's this guy. He's very well paid. He's worked on a number of very commercially successful films, part of the Bourne Identity films, part of the Mission Impossible, and then a number of critically acclaimed films. You'd think he'd have this big Hollywood attitude, but in fact, it's quite the contrary. And I call his chapter the Art of Collaboration. So this guy, he has a singular vision. He is an artist in his own right, but for him, and the way he got to being winning an Oscar, and the way he got to being at the top of his field, being paid a lot of money, in charge of these teams of workers, was not by being this big shot, you know, or having this big shot attitude, but by viewing himself as a collaborator with all these workers underneath him, and as a collaborator with the director. And here's the most important part. Really, his ultimate boss isn't even the director. It's the film itself. It's figuring out the best way to make it look and feel.
I even love the fact that he's aware that he's not good at shooting comedy.
Yeah, it was really funny to hear him talk about that he was saying, listen, I'm a comedy killer. And I said, what does cinematography have to do with comedy? So I don't want to give too much away in the book, but he started, you know, telling some interesting tales about Hollywood and how different stars have to be lit in certain ways to make them look a certain way. So what's interesting about Robert Elswit and all the Invisibles, they have this really, I think, unusual and an incredible hybrid of traits where they are both highly ambitious. Make no mistake, being an invisible, as I define them, doesn't mean that you are meek. It doesn't mean you're hiding in the corner somewhere in your office. There are all these people know that there are times when we need to promote ourselves and our work in different circumstances. So it's not about saying they are against putting their name out there when they need to. But what you see with Robert Elswit and all these other people is this real amazing combination of both ambition And confidence combined with real humility and a real sense of this team mentality. So it's a pretty remarkable and a very powerful combination of traits that I think is really overlooked a lot in our society. And, you know, one of the chapters in the book that's not a profile of a person, but I show a lot of international perspectives. And this probably won't surprise anyone that the United States is considered the most individualistic country on earth. But when you look at a lot of other countries around the world that have a bit more of a collectivist culture, you can think in the what they call the Confucian Belt, you know, China, part of South Korea and Japan to a certain degree, that they view themselves, people there, much less so in this notion of I and me, that they view themselves as part of the larger endeavor. And I'm not saying that those cultures are, that that path is superior to our path. What I am saying is that there, I think there's a balance between the two, and we've really gotten sort of off kilter with what our balance. For many years, if you think back to, you know, the Puritans and that sort of nose to the grindstone mentality that we had in the country, and you think in the last century, the company man, you know, silently, this sort of quiet dignity of the average American, as David Foster Wallace once referred to it. That was a really important part of America's success, combined with, we've always had that, what I call the American noise, when you think of our Hollywood Klieg lights shining to the world. So it's always been a marriage between these two things. And what I argue is that today, there's really been, this balance has now become out of balance, and that we are far more focused on the Hollywood Klieg light element and much less so on this quiet dignity of doing great work. And it's both to our personal and cultural detriment that we've really gotten out of kilter. And you see with these people in the book who are so successful and so fulfilled, they really show another path. But if I may just make one point connected to that, and I keep talking about the people in the book, you know, I wanted to have people who were very aspirational. So I chose people, it's fun reading about people who are great at what they do. But I also wanted people that we could relate to. And the thing is, they are not an exclusive group. Being an invisible, it's not like you are or are not. We all, I think, have different elements of these traits that they have. It's just they simply are at the far end of the spectrum that we all fall upon.
I don't think I'll go to my next concert and not think about how everything is where it needs to be and everything is perfectly tuned, thanks to your book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so one of the people in the book, I actually have two different people who work behind the scenes in musical enterprises, because I wanted to show both the similarities between them, but how they're in very different worlds. One of them is a guy named Pete Clements, who for the past 20 plus years has been the chief guitar technician for Radiohead, you know, one of the biggest and most respected bands in the world. And this, you know, this isn't a job that some 16-year-old kid's doing where he's tuning a guitar. You know, we're talking about many, many millions of dollars at stake, night after night, sold out shows in front of 20 or 30,000 people. You're traveling around with 18 tractor trailers filled with equipment. There's, I think, over 40 people on the traveling staff, and then an additional scores of people every night at the venues who are working. This is a very big enterprise. His role is critical. He's taking care of their precious assets. And I get into an extraordinary amount of detail about what his job entails. And what I want to show in the book, the other musical person was a man named Peter Stumpf, who is a piano technician for the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, which is considered one of the most renowned orchestras in the world. And he labors on their Steinway grand piano before each concert series. It takes many, many days, and it's incredibly nuanced work. And he works, you know, and he said to me, he's like, and this is one of my favorite lines in the book. He said, you know, when I'm sitting in the audience and Emmanuel Ax, who for those who don't follow classical music, this is a very famous pianist, when Emmanuel Ax is on stage and I'm in the audience, I feel as though we're having a duet. That the piano is him. He said, my name is never in the program, you know, and I don't care. No one will ever think about the piano technician, and the fans at a Radiohead show or any concert, they never think of Pete Clements when, you know, it's all, and frankly, his job is for the band not to think of him either. His job is to make sure that everything is perfect. And if with a little bit of luck on his side, he remains invisible. Literally, he's in the shadows. He's in the dark. And I was fortunate enough to be there with him in the dark, in the shadows, on stage right at the concert. So, you know, where is his reward? All these people, again, I just keep returning to, where is their reward and how did they get there? And you see it with their traits and with their mentality. That's how they got to this place where they are.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Lee in Fort Worth. Hello, Lee.
Hi, Chris. And I'm really looking forward to reading your book, David.
I am
now a licensed attorney and a law professor, but I worked for 7 years as a paralegal. And I agree with so much of what you're saying. Being part of a team, basically as a paralegal, you're doing like a de facto role as an attorney. You're doing everything except signing your name, which means, great, you get the attagirl, you know, pat on the back, et cetera. But you don't have the risk of, it's my signature at the end of a document, you know, and it's going to be my name on the hook. And so I think the benefit of working with a team in that capacity is you are part of a team and you are getting to experience the greater good for your client or working with a group of individuals. As an attorney now, I find it sometimes more fulfilling, but a lot of times a lot less fulfilling and certainly a lot more stressful because it's my name at the end of the document and that's a big detriment of, you know, you want to get all of the credit, but at the end of the day, it does create a lot more internal stress for you.
What do you think about that, David?
Yeah, I mean, listen, everyone has different personalities and what suits them, you know, and I think it's a great point about paralegals and how important they are. And frankly, I actually spoke with to a group of lawyers yesterday, and even the people who are putting their names in the documents, the majority of their work is done behind the scenes, you know, other than the billable hours that the client knows about. Clients rarely know about everything that you're doing. And that's the same for, I think, most fields. The people who are the most satisfied really revel, really savor that role of the work. If you're seeking attention in order to feel good, it's really a losing game. And that's one of the things that I think gets lost in this larger message we have in the culture today. When you think about, you know, people willing to humiliate themselves to get on a reality TV show, to nearly all of us spending so much time online where we're all, I mean, let's be honest, we're all secretly always hoping to have more and more likes on every Facebook post. And it always feels like a little bit of a failure when the most recent one doesn't get enough traction. So it's really a losing game. And I think my book, I try to just have it as this really uplifting and powerful reminder that there is another way toward success and toward feeling really fulfilled that we often just don't think about amidst all the noise in the culture today.
We're speaking to author David Zweig about his new book, Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. Join the conversation now at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author David Zweig, whose new book is is Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org, which is where we hear from AV, who says, I wanted to mention someone like my mother who works in blood banking. Most people don't fully understand how integral and huge a part blood, its collection and transaction plays in successful medical practice, but I know nothing fulfills her more than knowing she helped match the type needed for a very sick child to undergo surgery. Great example.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a wonderful example. You know, I was just thinking back to how you mentioned, you know, you're never going to attend a concert the same way again. And I'm so glad you mentioned that because as powerful and important as the messages, quote unquote, are from the book about how to gain success that these people show another path and how to really find fulfillment through these people, If nothing else, when someone reads this book, after you're done, you will never enter an airport the same way again. Right? You will never go to a concert and experience that the same way again. You will never think about politics at the UN. You will never see a skyscraper the same way again. So one of the things, if nothing else, I want it to be this thing where you have this window is open into all these worlds about that affect how we see and smell. One of the people in the book is a master perfumer. And he talks about how, you know, when you smell this fragrance of a spouse or your mom or an old flame, that we always, you know, that someone is behind that fragrance. So,
and it's not P. Diddy who came up with
it. It's not P. Diddy. I talk about the backdrop of his chapter is how P. Diddy, Sean John, a.k.a. P. Diddy, right, the top-selling male prestige celebrity fragrance that Dave Appel is the man in the book who created it. And you follow, it's an amazing story where he's working with Diddy to create this fragrance. And, you know, the technical knowledge that Dave Appel as the perfumer has, it's like rivals that of a chemistry PhD. It's remarkable, yet he's also an artist. And so all of these worlds, whether it's perfumes, skyscrapers, going to concerts, going through an airport, everything is going to look a little bit different to you, or a lot bit different, after you're done with the book.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Sally in Dallas. Hello, Sally.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious to know if it sounds like the majority of people that you've discussed, at least, are probably fairly well compensated for the work they do. And I wonder if that also might contribute to, you know, their ability to find fulfillment in other ways than through their work. Do you know what I'm saying? Do they have opportunities to seek out attention and acknowledgement because they're in a position to be able to do that financially? Or did you interview people who maybe were not particularly well compensated and still found similar responses?
Right. Well, as fact checkers aren't necessarily highly compensated. But the thing about, think about all the well-off people in our world and, in our country, do most of them seem happy? Think about so many of the celebrities in our world, particularly you think of like reality star celebrities with their, their kind of meltdowns are documented, regularly every week in Us Weekly, that if people think that, oh, but they're well off, an anesthesiologist, that's one of the professions I cover in the book, are anesthesiologists. Now, of course, we've all heard of them, but, after you have a surgery, you never thank the anesthesiologist. It's always, you'll probably never forget the name of the person who removed your gallbladder, but once you're out of recovery, you've already forgotten about the anesthesiologist. Yet everyone in the hospital knows that the anesthesiologist runs the OR. Your life is in that person's hands. So these people are very well paid for sure, some of them, but they could have gone into a variety of fields where they are paid even more or comparably. If you think about the amount of training that goes into being an anesthesiologist, one of the people I met with, this guy went to an Ivy League medical school. He's at a top university hospital. He could have been a surgeon if he wanted. He could have worked in finance or something, but he chose to do something where he knew that the patient would likely never acknowledge his work. But he wanted to do it because he finds the work itself rewarding. So I think the proof is really in the pudding with these people regarding what really brings fulfillment. Because think about all the people you know who are well off and whether that's brought them happiness or not.
What do managers need to understand if they have a small percentage of visible workers and maybe a larger percentage of invisible workers about making sure that everybody does get acknowledged in a way that is appropriate and feels right for that worker?
Yeah, I mean, we all have different roles in different contexts. But for the people who are invisible workers, either in a specific role where it's always going to be behind the scenes or just by personality, people who tend to be more self-effacing. There's a lot of people I talk to who really resent this notion. They're very anxious about this kind of broader notion in our culture that they have to constantly promote themselves. But believe it or not, there are a lot of people who really just want to do their work. They don't need the attaboy, pat on the back. They're like, great, let me just get the job done. And what managers need to know is that oftentimes what just offering more money, not that that's always an option, that that's actually not necessarily the most effective way of keeping these workers happy. That, you know, there's people hear about companies like Google, and 3M does this, where they give, I think it's like 20% time, where X amount of time a worker is allowed to spend using their skills on something that's very rewarding for them. So something like that's just an example about a way of retaining great talent in your company, but with it, but giving them what they want, which isn't necessarily more attention or maybe not even more money. Not that invisibles are against earning money, but finding rewards, and all workers will respond to this. And this, so a lot of research shows that these people with these invisible traits that I talk about really elevate the whole work environment. So if you create an environment where those people are respected and where it's maybe perhaps frowned upon for people to always toot their own horn or CCing everyone on every email every time they do something, if you dial that down, it creates more of a communal environment where people aren't kind of in competition with the person down the hall, but instead walk from their office down to the other person's office and say, hey, let's work together on this. So there's a lot of really interesting research in the business scholarship realm where they show this. And again, to me, while the book is filled with lots of interesting research studies, what really drives the book are the stories of these people themselves. That's where you really get to kind of just absorb the message of how they've become successful and the companies or enterprises that they work for, why they are successful when they highlight these types of invisible workers in the appropriate way.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Adam on the line in Dallas. Hi, Adam.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question had to deal with how this sort of topic relates to the American dream, because I feel as Americans, we grow up in this sort of society where we kind of, where I guess society kind of pushes us to be this, the, like you said, the Hollywood, like, success story, the big blockbuster. I was wondering how the Invisibles, that kind of aspect also ties in with the American dream. Is it like their dream to be as a role, to play a role in society, or, you know, something along those lines?
Yeah, well, I talk a fair amount in the book about putting the Invisibles in a broader context, both within our country, and I think I mentioned that earlier during the interview now with you, talking about how we've had these kind of dual roles that when they were balanced, I think created a really successful society, both for people personally and culturally, where you have this kind of quiet nose to the grindstone married with this kind of better American noise that we're so great at, and that it's out of balance now when you talk about like the American dream. That at one point years ago, the American dream was, I think, for lack of a better word, a bit more humble. And today, it seems that more and more people are seeking attention, and that that's the metric of value above all else. That unless I gain fame, and there's a bunch of really kind of alarming studies that I cite from, you know, the Pew Research Center and other places like that, where they talk about the amount of people, particularly in younger generations, where fame or gaining attention is like considered their most important life goal. So, and I talk with a bunch of people in the business realm, consultants and other people in employment agencies, we're talking about where they were saying more and more people are approaching us seeking jobs that are all in these very high-profile, either high-profile industries in general, like entertainment and such, or just the high-profile role within a particular field. And what's happened is there's a real dearth of people applying for jobs that are critical but that are going unfilled. So in kind of a deflated employment environment, people are really allocating their attention and their desires toward, I think, the wrong path in a lot of cases. There always are going to be people who want to be stars out front, and that's terrific. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think most of us and a lot of people seem to be really kind of led down a path toward this illusion of thinking that that's going to bring you happiness. You're going to feel powerful and terrific. And because of I talk a good amount about how the internet today, and particularly social media, plays into this, and how it both like enables and amplifies, I think, this tendency toward attention that we think, oh, once you're online, anyone can become famous. But one of the academics I spoke with, he really likened it to the notion of playing the lottery, that yes, you can buy a lottery ticket and there's a chance you might win, but you probably won't. It's the same thing of like this notion of trying to create a viral video. You know, I mean, the likelihood of you getting a really viral video on YouTube is about one in a million. So it's really something that people are striving for, but it's largely an illusion that they're chasing. They're never going to get there.
And it's a real distraction, right? It takes a lot of time to be super self-promotional or it's always funny when you say try to create a viral video. It's almost like an oxymoron there.
Right. I mean, of course. And by the way, if you Google something like how to create a viral meme or something like that, I mean, the brrr, it just goes on and on and on. The amount of people are trying to crack the code. Guess what? There's no way to crack the code here. And you know, you're right with what you were saying about that. That it's, again, I view this as really heartening and encouraging, but that the evidence seems to show that when I say the evidence, I'm talking about both a lot of scholarly research, but again, just seeing the examples of these people in the book who are very successful. They got there not by spending any time promoting themselves. They got there by doing great work. And I can see that in my own career as a writer. You know, I feel this pressure. I'm supposed to be more and more active online on Facebook and on Twitter. And I enjoy myself sometimes on Twitter communicating with people. But what I've learned not to do is try to spend a tremendous amount of time trying to gain followers and all this stuff. Because in the end, What brings you success is doing more work. You know, I ultimately got the book deal for this book because I pitched an article to The Atlantic about this idea. It was, what do fact checkers and anesthesiologists have in common? And I almost didn't even pitch the article because I was working on something else at the time. And had I just spent more time trying to promote myself, I wouldn't be here talking with you on the radio today. That sometimes the best way to get more attention, it's ironic, but if you want attention, sometimes the best way to get attention is to just simply do the work and the attention will follow. It's a bit of like, you know, the cart before the horse thing. One of the quotes in the book is from a writer who said, you don't get good work by having a lot of followers. He said, doing good work gets you followers. Followers don't get you, you know, good work. I'm doing a horrible paraphrase, but you got the idea.
It's almost like, you know, stop looking for the love of your life and that person will show up.
It really is. And again, you know, just to make the nuanced point, I'm not saying that we don't need to promote ourselves at times. You know, we all do. It's not about hiding your head in the sand or being someone who's meek and in the corner. And there's also nothing wrong with getting attention sometimes. It's a lot of fun, you know, having my name on the cover of the book. And it feels good when you're in the office and someone appreciates work that you do. So it's not about running away from those things. It's about what motivates you, and it's about what you're really spending your time on. And again and again, and these people in these really wide range of fields show that when you really love what you do, that's how you ultimately are going to find the most success, and also how you're going to really find the deepest fulfillment. That chasing attention, it's like a drug. It's never going to be enough. It's very ephemeral. It just fades away. It feels good, but then it disappears. The things that really last are the work itself and the rewards of digging in and doing something that's rewarding and finding a challenge. And if you revel in that role, you're going to find success. And you can see how these people did this. These people who are paid well, who are at the tops of these fields, that's how they got there. Not by promoting themselves, but by doing good work. They're showing us another way to get there.
Seems like these ideas should be on the minds of every career counselor out there, every school counselor helping students choose what they want to do with their lives.
My God, good point. Yeah. And, you know, and I spoke with, like I said, a number of people who work in recruiting and consulting, and they talked about there's a real problem with that. You know, and I'm doing a bit of lecturing at universities now where they're calling me in saying, you need to talk to people so they understand about where to really put their values, you know, what makes sense, both if you're just being very kind of practical about it, about how can I earn a lot of money, you know, if that's someone's aim, you know, and how can I find a successful career? But I think in a much more wise sense, beyond just trying to make money, how am I going to be fulfilled in my life? How do you define success in the end? And I think a lot of people, because of just the culture at large and the value we place on attention and kind of even at the far end of that fame, that we forget that what really brings value has nothing to do with that for most of the time.
David Zweig's new book is Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. It's been great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.